For the first time in about 9 years, our Newsmakers guest today woke up and either wasn't running for office or holding public office. Barbara Lawton, who yesterday was Lieutenant Governor. Today, you're just private citizen, Barbara Lawton.
Looking for a parking spot on the Capitol Square.
You lost your parking spot. You had to give up the first floor office.
Brutal reality.
A brutal reality. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming in to talk about things like that.
Thank you.
How are you doing on your first day without a title?
Fine. I mean, there's a certain feeling of being unfettered, which might be dangerous to someone. I'm not in office. I'm not running for office, and I have no plans ever again to run for office.
Really?
So
are you taking the cure?
That gives you a sense of freedom. Yes.
Now, you and I have heard that I never say never or never rule out anything, but
I think we could be pretty confident in this. You could maybe even bet your first grandchild on that.
They're too dear. I have six. What's your number now?
I'm only at four, at four.
I understand.
Yeah. Well, how to boast.
Let's go back to that.
Let's get into a power struggle,
you have
Stephen.
A numbers game.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to that. If Herb Cole said, this is enough, would you consider running for the U.S. Senate?
I really have no interest in running for office again. I'm going to am in the process of discovering a way to have an impact on the things that mean a lot to me.
Right.
It's not that I will disappear from public life or from trying to influence the way that we make decisions and the way that people engage in civic life, but I don't think that I'm going to run for office again.
Well, what are the touchstones on your personal search for your next career opportunity?
When you say what are the touchstones?
What are you going to be looking for? What are the doors you're going to try to open? Are you going to try to open a nonprofit?
I don't feel confined in that sense. So, the nonprofit world is a world that I've already begun conversations in, but there's also interesting opportunities in some places, a smaller pool in the private sector. I'm more interested perhaps in the nonprofit. You know, one of the things that I have developed over 8 years is a unique perspective and therefore I think a honed expertise in understanding the point of intersection of the nonprofit and the public sector
right.
and the private sector.
Yes.
And whose role is what and how they can and should work together better. And where one needs to stay in one's lane. And I think right now we're at a critical moment in our state and in the nation in understanding that, making smarter use of partnerships, but not allowing philanthropy to supplant the role of government. And I have very strong, as you can imagine, strong feelings about this and deep concerns. And I have watched in some small areas where people have become dependent on private contributions, on philanthropy, for what had traditionally been a role of government.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's okay. But sometimes that's not at all okay, because once you supplant the responsibility of the public sector, it's very hard, if not impossible, to get it back. And you may have weakened a democratic government by doing that. I mean, I remember even here in Madison getting a phone call asking me to work with the Schools Foundation, a foundation in support of the public schools.
Right.
And I actually founded one in Green Bay mm-hmm. in support of the public schools. But when I looked at some of the granting that they were doing, including teacher training, I said, come back to me when you've cleaned this up. Because faculty development or professional development is actually a role of the schools. And if we give that up and then your tastes change and you start doing something else with your money, we're stuck without this on a budget line.
Are you going to dial yourself down as a big D Democrat in order to engage on some of these issues that mean the most to you now?
Well, I think I've actually for 8 years been dialed down in some sense as a big D Democrat. You know, I've there's a lot that's odd about the job of lieutenant governor.
I was going to ask you.
But there is a luxury in it in that I couldn't sign or veto legislation.
Right.
I could move it forward, but I couldn't be the named sponsor. And so I worked in a bipartisan way on most everything, and I have very solid relationships with Republicans as well as Democrats. And there are things that matter to me that some people think as having a partisan identification. I've actually worked hard to force that out of the frame and to have it, if we think about the creative economy. Should that be Republican or Democrat? I don't think so. I've worked to help people find a way to have common ground instead of get into these partisan divisions.
As you look for the next career identity, what are the two or three issues or passions that really move you now?
Well, actually, I've found quite a few in office.
Just
and,
two
and
or
this
three.
Is, I know. This is very difficult in terms of someone said, what's your ideal for your next step? And
mm-hmm.
I said, if I knew that, I would be halfway there or maybe already there. But I am not having the luxury of being a generalist. Maybe I will find a way to continue to do that. But as a lieutenant governor, I had to be. But I've been I was convinced to step off the curb and run for office because of my passionate commitment to public education. And it's not just K-12. I've tried to force Wisconsin to join Minnesota and Illinois, especially in Chicago, where the business community leads support for better early care and childhood education
mm-hmm.
because they see it as an economic development issue.
Investing in the next generation of workers
right.
and leaders.
Right, but also investing in this generation because if we don't have access to high quality care and education for preschool children, those people decide to go to Minneapolis and Chicago where they have invested in affordable access
right.
to that. So it's an immediate and an urgent economic development issue. And it saves us money on remediation and ensures a higher level of productivity and performance of the next generation. So that's of great interest. But on the other end of it, I've provided national leadership on higher education development of our policy and thinking about that and how it fits into our economic development as a state and a nation. So those are big issues to me. But as you know, I've worked hard on the creative economy. And our Wisconsin Arts Board has taken national leadership positions, whether we're talking about developing the creative capacities of the workforce to now leading the network of the National Creativity Network
mm-hmm.
that comes out of the World Creativity Forum. And Wisconsin isn't first. The state of Oklahoma was in becoming a creative state and looking at it as an economic development initiative. But we're next in line, and we're providing the chairmanship for that.
Creative economy. What do you think would be the biggest step Wisconsin could take to create or to foster this new creative economy?
Well, one of the strategies that we've been working in the Arts Board is to work with the regional economic development organizations that have remapped the state. And have them begin to understand how important the arts and culture sector is to their regional economy. It is as a job provider and a revenue generator,
mm-hmm.
and the data is there to show them and to be very convincing. But more than that, it's a magnetic force for the workforce and the businesses that follow them. So when you look at, for instance, Centergy, when I met with them last spring and it was going to be my last time that I was addressing them, they said, "We listened to you. You told us that you have to move the creative sector from the little kids' table to the big kids' table,
right.
to the executive committee, so that as you're imagining economic development for a region, you're including a sector that has tremendous potential for growth, but is critical to your growth in other areas as well." So if I were giving advice to Governor Walker, I would say I believe that the most wise counsel that he can seek for economic development comes from the regional economic development groups, Governor Doyle convened them once, and that was it. And they all are developing in different ways, along different paths, and that's part of the value that they have, is that they're organic and they spring from the ground in which they are. But they have a lot to teach each other. And they have a lot of local and regional wisdom to inform a larger state policy. And some of them have evolved more quickly than others, and you could move them all, I think, along a faster trajectory mm-hmm. if you were convening them. And then you would learn so much about how to keep a vision for a state that really is going to be effective. But as a pulse, you know, the heartbeat of every one of those comes out of the arts and culture sector.
I've watched quite a few governors, so I'm not speaking, I'm speaking beyond
well,
the last.
We're both a little long of tooth, aren't we?
Well, yes, but.
We've watched them.
So I'm speaking beyond the last 8 years.
Yeah.
Governors traditionally proscribe what their lieutenant governors can do. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt do this. Were you frustrated that, do you believe you could have been given more responsibility over the last
well,
8 years?
Governors maybe proscribe actively and passively.
That's true.
You know, I mean, there's a, I want you to head the arts board, for instance,
right.
or not putting you in charge of something is sort of a passive-aggressive prescription. So you see different ways of coming at that. But from my point of view, I was asked to do a lot, to travel the state to support different things on the governor's agenda. But there was space left for me to create my own agenda. So not filling my plate was sort of setting me free to develop an agenda that would be complementary. I mean, it wasn't in conflict because it was completely geared toward economic development in the state of Wisconsin. But I bring a different perspective. And working from that position, the power of convening I discovered was extraordinary. And it was a responsibility I had to discover and use it well.
Where is it, though? I can't find it in the Constitution or the statute that governors and lieutenant governors often don't get along. I mean, Patrick Lucey, Marty Shriver, Tommy McCallum. I don't want to overstate it, but are you frustrated by your relations with Governor Doyle
goodness,
last year?
No, thank goodness. One of the values of membership in a professional organization like the National Lieutenant Governors Association is to gain perspective so that you understand how it's working nationwide in 50 states and 5 territories. And there is an inherent tension in that relationship between a governor and a governor's successor
mm-hmm.
that is permeates all of those relationships. And oftentimes, in the best of relationships, some of the, I've observed a few that were remarkably productive because of the cohesion and the way that they work. That tone is set by a governor. But knowing the lieutenant governors well, even with the governor's intent, it couldn't always be accomplished easily because staff was working to undermine it.
Wow.
And there's that tension there as well. So there had to be a very determined act by a governor if you were going to have a very strong relationship.
But tell me if I'm wrong. I would not consider you and Governor Doyle as being close.
No,
is that a fair assessment?
Not close.
You were not close.
Right.
You had different views of how to operate. But you alluded to staff. Barbara, the most full-time staff you ever had was what, 4 or 5?
4.
4, that's which is less than many leaders of the Assembly and Senate.
Right.
I just interviewed the state treasurer. He has 14. So one approach you...
I started with 3. When Margaret Farrow had a staff of 7, I believe. It was cut to 3 when we took office.
Yeah.
And then I literally could not meet the governor's demands of my office. And he added one back, but it wasn't formally added to the office of the lieutenant
governor. You tried to...
So that disappeared again later.
You tried to do more with an army of interns. Which
interns and volunteers.
Interns and volunteers, mm-hmm. which is bringing in students that are those that are not long of tooth, to use your term, as you and I, that may not be experienced, that may not know the protocols, that may. Well, but so, how did it work? To use
excellent. We had a.
But there you
were
rotated
there were
continually.
Others. I know you were constant. Some stayed. I mean, one intern who worked for me for 4 years as an intern, and mind you, I didn't have a budget to pay them. So I was, their generosity allowed me to have a very ambitious agenda. And maybe they could do it for one semester for credit, but that was about it.
Yeah.
So, but I had quite a few repeating. And we, because we needed them, it was such valuable experience. They weren't doing filing. They were doing very significant work. And I promised them introductions and great recommendations.
Okay.
And you know, one of those interns ended up being my chief of staff at the end. And I and he
so
was
you watch
extraordinary.
Them grow.
Yes.
You watch them
but
grow.
I also found that when I took on a project and someone asked me to lead this, let's say, LEAP, the program with the American Association of Colleges and Universities in Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin system had agreed to be a pilot for that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was asked to serve on the National Leadership Council, then Kevin Riley asked me to also lead the state one. So I was working as a national leader, and he asked me to be a state leader. And I said, I'm happy to do that, except I have no staff to assign to that.
Right.
So you will have to staff me on that. And so I learned to, if I was working on mental health parity, which we did a lot of work on.
You got passed.
And we got it passed, but we had the biggest lobbying day. We also had the largest state participation on National Depression Awareness or National Depression Screening Day
mm-hmm.
of any state in the nation ever. And we had 750,000 people invited to participate coming out of my little office. But there again, I worked with the National Federation of Independent Businesses and WMC and all sorts of people, but you leech from them, leech staff support to build things like
leech.
That.
One of them, job one for you has always mm-hmm. been development of a next generation of women mm-hmm. political leaders.
Yes.
Did you leave office yesterday optimistic at the odds of women becoming political leaders, or do you feel that
not yet.
No, because I've always asked you how far are we away from a woman governor? Are we further away than when you took office?
I don't know. There are some good women serving in positions that may lead them there. And if we get smarter about A, valuing their contribution, and understanding actually how important it is to have a balance of perspectives and diversity, and starting with a number one gender diversity in decision making in the public arena as well as the private arena. If we begin to really value that, then maybe we'll be more determined and assertive about breaking down the barriers that are there. But barriers are there within parties, within caucuses, in the public realm, with the media coverage of women. And this is something that I think is an important study to be done. We have this Center for Integrity, and I would love to see them pick up. And let's just see how many mentions there are. If you could take a closed, one media outlet or something, and see how many mentions there are of the women in office compared to the men in office. We have two women in Congress. And believe me, I think if you started to count the number of articles that cover the work they're doing, I found this constantly. Part of it you might say is, oh, well, it's because she's lieutenant governor and not governor. But when you're doing stuff that has a wide-reaching impact, that shouldn't be the issue. If you're covering the media is covering things of equal importance or lesser importance, then you're looking at gender as the issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Wisconsin has two Democratic women who are both Democrats. So my question is the Democratic Party more open to talented women moving up than the Republican Party? Are there more barriers on the Republican side than Democrat?
There have been more barriers on the Republican side, and I say this because one of the projects of my women's initiative was to look at how we could get women to begin to create that common ground in the legislature where it had become so divided by partisan lines. So I worked to convene a women's caucus. Most states have had one for decades, mm-hmm. and Wisconsin had never had one. And I'm not a legislator, but I thought somebody needs to do this. So I sent out an invitation to all of the women in both parties in both houses to come to a meeting in my office. And we got maybe seven, if I recall correctly, two Republicans, five Democrats. But they were really excited at the prospect. So they said, let's have another meeting. So I sent out an invitation, and mm-hmm. the numbers grew to the point that then they said, let's meet socially out of the Capitol and have dinner together. So we sent out an invitation. And then the then Speaker John Gard said there was a caucus meeting at the same time.
Oh.
So one of the women said, let's meet later. In the end, he prohibited them from participating and threatened them with their committee assignments. So yes, there's a difference. And that was a moment where we could have begun to see women empowered by their shared perspective to force it. When women lead, it's not that the gender becomes an issue, but the agenda changes because we understand priorities from a different perspective. And so this was a very important moment that was stymied. We've watched strong leaders like Mary Pantzer be cannibalized by their own party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is a difference. But believe me, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin has a long way to go.
On that note, how do you feel about the Republican wave elections in November? Why did the Republicans have such a good year to elect a governor and control of both houses of the legislature and the U.S. House? What happened to your party? Is it on the run? Is it in disarray?
Well, I think that it had, first, a lot to do with the economic context. You know, if you go back
to the recession, the Great Recession?
The Great Recession and the sense, the deep sense of insecurity that people were feeling across the state. And I was still through that whole election cycle, of course, traveling the state as an elected official and getting a real sense of it. That deep sense of insecurity breeds frustration, and the next step is anger. And what the Republican Party was good at doing was pushing that next step from frustration to anger. And there's a kind of an unfettered anger. What the Democratic Party did not do well at was pulling it back in and offering a vision that helped restore a sense of promise of security again. And remember in the Massachusetts election that Scott Brown was elected,
yes,
over Martha Croakley, one of in interviews after that, you heard again and again a Democrat saying, I voted Democrat all my life, but I was so angry and they weren't listening. There was an interview last week with Congressman Obie on public radio, and somebody called in and said, Congressman Obie, I've had the honor of voting for you for, you know, so many times. I've watched you for decades. Thank you for your service, but I would not have voted for you, and I didn't vote for the Democrat this time, and I'm not going to next time either because I'm so angry. His anger was, as I understood it, it sounded like, was the Democrats have become the same as the Republicans. There's other kinds of anger out there, but what we have to do is articulate a clear vision, and that's what was missing, because there was disarray, you know, unfortunately.
Do you think the Wisconsin Democratic Party is in deeper trouble than the party nationally? And I ask that with the context of November 2nd, when your party lost the governor and the...
Right. Well, and we lost Senator Feingold, and now you need to look at the leadership structure to measure whether there's strong resilience and the capacity to rebound. And
do you want to be part of that debate, the rebounding of the Wisconsin Democratic Party or are you going to try to?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I want to be part of that debate. I want to see us right now. I'm very intent on making sure that we restore the a sense of our state Supreme Court as an independent branch of government.
You're referring to the
and I'm
April
referring
election?
To the April election where
Justice Prosser have you endorsed someone else?
No.
Do you plan to?
Not with two good women running right now.
Understand. Well, yeah. But explain, why is this a bellwether? Why is it such an important election?
This is such an important election because Justice Prosser, who has not stood for election before, he was appointed to the court, and who comes from a very partisan background as Speaker of the House and as one of the most partisan people there, who has slipped into that language, who's defended Scott Jensen, for goodness sakes, mm-hmm. of all people, and who in the announcement from his campaign of a new campaign manager says that they are looking forward to working with Governor Walker and the Republican-led legislature. I would like to think that our Supreme Court is an independent branch that is meant to balance the executive branch and the legislative branch. Clearly, they have lost that vision.
Well, does that mean that if a woman survives a primary, and if it's a woman X, you say you have two qualified women candidates?
Two qualified women who come from, one the public defender's office and one the attorney general's office.
Right.
Women with a deep understanding of the judicial system who also respect it as an independent branch. I mean, if it were a perfect world, I would have the difficult decision, and so would you, of which one to vote for in the general.
But
this electorate understands what's at stake in this election, those two will be in the general.
But if it's Justice Prosser and a woman, are you going to be very high-profile, active, trying to elect the woman nominee?
And it is not just because they are women,
Stephen. I understand.
It's because these are people who understand.
You originally said they're two very well-qualified.
Right.
Yeah.
And they happen to be women. In this case, I mean, I understand in the legislative process and the judicial and the executive how important it is to have a balance of perspectives. In this race, what is incredibly important is a commitment to an independent judicial branch and a court.
And you're going to be active in that, aren't you?
You bet.
You bet. Okay.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be active in a county executive race, but not here. Unlikely here.
In Milwaukee.
Yes, because
and who
it's
do you like
so
there?
Important, State Senator Jim Sullivan. I was so disappointed that he was not reelected because he is one of the leaders, with or without Democrat behind his name, because as a candidate for county executive, you are running as a without a partisan attachment. This is an incredibly bright, thoughtful, strategic, visionary sort of person, the kind that we need to have lead in our state, and certainly in our largest and most populous county, with so many issues that are left behind.
You're going to stay very active, aren't you? In the political dialogue these key races.
In these key races. And interestingly, those are both nonpartisan, but where I know how much it matters. And spring elections are often hard, barely can get turn the head of people around the state. It better turn their head this time. We have county executive races contested in Green Bay, in Appleton, in Milwaukee, and Madison, as well as other places.
Right.
And the county's association has become is working at being more engaged in policy conversations. So those county executive races are very important. Collectively, they can have a huge impact on our state, and must.
Your decision to not run for governor, right? Still convinced it was the right decision?
I had no choice.
You had no choice?
I had no choice. And it wasn't to not run for governor. It was to end my campaign for governor. I announced a campaign in August, and I ended it the end of October.
And you had no choice because it was not winnable? I mean, I have this, my theory, you were somebody I'm told on a Friday you were committed and up and talking to people,
because
and then Saturday.
I was in Milwaukee at.
Did you get a call from somebody saying you would be running against Governor Doyle and the White House?
I already knew that.
You already knew that?
Oh, I already knew that.
So then what happened?
Every morning when you're doing that and you're doing something that is akin to a startup business, and in this case, a startup business that is going to require you to attract and raise something around, $11 million,
yes.
$14 million?
Lots of zeros.
Lots of zeros. And you have to keep a pace. You can't manage that without keeping a certain pace.
Yes.
So every day, if you're being responsible, you're doing the calculations. You're checking the numbers, because it is absolutely irresponsible to the people whose jobs you are providing and the people you're asking for them to invest in some sense in your vision for this state. If at some point, if you're not going to be able
to not there.
Leap over that hurdle, you have to stop. And you go full out until the numbers are absolutely clear, and then you stop.
And that was the reason.
Yeah.
And that was the toughest call of your public life?
Absolutely.
Toughest call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But it was right.
Well, you just watched Governor Walker take the oath.
I did.
And you're hearing the emerging priorities of the new Republican governor, Senate, and Assembly. Do those priorities worry you?
Well, no, his priority, he says, his stated priority is jobs, jobs, jobs. And I hope that he understands. I was trying to cull that from his inaugural speech.
Mm-hmm.
The function of government is not actually job creation per se. It's to create the economic context in which jobs are created.
Mm-hmm.
And so to understand how you can most effectively do that and what will do it, create jobs that pay family supporting wages and create a sustainable economy and one that has the potential for growth, is maybe not as simple a formula as some people think. And my hope is that he surrounds himself with advisors who have differing ideas about that, so that he can shake out the best possible plan for this state.
It is important to you that the you were a woman as the lieutenant governor, and Mrs. Clayfish is. Is it important that a woman stay in the job as lieutenant governor, or do you have such differences with issues on Rebecca that's less important?
Well, those are two very separate questions.
Yes, ma'am.
It's important to me that women lead in this state. And whether they lead from the office of governor, which we wish were so, or U.S. senator, which has not happened in Wisconsin yet either, or the office of lieutenant governor, which at least has higher visibility, or legislative seats, or wherever,
mm-hmm.
It's important. Rebecca Clayfish and I may have have extensive differences in our ideological thinking or perspective. Maybe not so extensive in certain priorities, and we've had extensive conversations.
Have you?
Oh, yes. I wrote to her when she won the nomination and again when she won the election, invited her to go to the National Lieutenant Governors Association meeting, which was also a boot camp
mm-hmm.
for lieutenant governors, so that she could get colleagues right away, which I think is very important, and get a really deep perspective on the responsibility. I mean, we go back to, and I think a lot of people forget this, that the first role named in the Constitution and our statutes is to serve as successor to the governor. Last year, 5 lieutenant governors succeeded the governor in office.
Yes.
It's an unlikely possibility in some ways, but those are pretty high numbers.
You have to be ready.
You have to be ready. And so for her to understand how to do that, to serve responsibly for the people of Wisconsin, and to have support to be able to do that quickly was very important. I want her, if it's a perfect world, we all want Governor Walker and his administration and Rebecca Clavish to succeed at building a strong economy and a state that welcomes all of us to make our best contribution. I wanted Rebecca Clavish to have a smooth transition and access to what she needed to start with strength. So our office was open to her and her staff for the entire time, anytime. And she and I had long conversations. I offered, you know, if you need, you don't have to accept these, but we've really honed a scheduling form and this mm-hmm. and this. It's all yours, whatever you need. Because it's really important that they operate from a position of strength. I hope with a focus, as I said, on building a strong, sustainable economy that pulls everyone into that prosperity.
Do you hope Governor Walker uses her more, plugs her in more to the daily activities of being governor and running state government than you were plugged in?
I hope that he, if in the very first level, relies on her counsel and her input as he is making decisions. As I said, when I've watched other very productive relationships between a governor and a lieutenant governor, the governor sought the counsel and the input of the lieutenant governor on everything from judicial appointments to budget decisions. Mm-hmm. And I hope that he does that with Rebecca Clavish, because otherwise, you know, that was one of the most important lessons for me as lieutenant governor. When I remember one meeting with the arts board where I had the luxury of selecting who the governor appointed to the arts board, and created a very interesting, diverse group by every measure, by the talents they brought to the table, their geography, their age, gender, ethnicity, race, blah, 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 everything. Anyway. But one day, as one of the arts board members was speaking on something, and I thought, who invited him? And then I thought, oh, you did.
Oh, you did.
Because if you don't have a 360-degree perspective at the table, as you are sorting through your decision-making process, you won't get it right.
Many people were surprised when you agreed to keynote the Freedom from Religion National Convention. Why did you agree to do that?
I agreed to do it for two reasons. One, because it, as the lieutenant governor of the state of Wisconsin, when national conferences...
It was a national event,
It was a national event. They came to our state. They asked if I could do opening remarks, welcoming. And I do that if my schedule allows it. And I've done it for the American Legion and the Society of Plastic Industries, and I did it for the Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Okay. So it's part of the job description.
Part of the job description. But I had another reason as well that made it an invitation that I welcomed, because both of my grandfathers were ministers. One was a Lutheran minister in Stoughton, and he was an immigrant, a 20th century immigrant, who actually preached his early sermons in Norwegian. He was a fire and brimstone preacher, I'll tell you. And my other grandfather was a Baptist minister, which followed a law career. And he ministered to prisoners and people with alcohol and drug problems. He came from a family that settled in this country early in the founding of our country. So I had these both of them able to fulfill what they felt was their calling, to the fullest of their calling, mm-hmm. because of a clear line between church and state. And my father flew 36 missions as the pilot of a B-17 bomber over Germany to protect that in our Constitution.
Yes.
So I found that it's part of my patriotism and part of my preserving their legacy to do that. And a lot of people misunderstood that. Some people who misunderstood, and you can imagine it, because it got front page news, which I thought was curious, very curious, but it ginned up a lot of phone calls and emails and excitement for my understaffed office. But as that was explained to people, a lot of people backed away from their anxiety about it, because I think we have to be serious. And I must say that the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has that as part of their mission, of really policing that line between between church and state, mm-hmm. and that part of it they do very well, and I don't worry about it. I don't feel a need to be an activist in that, because they're doing their job so well. So we all ought to be grateful to them.
Yeah, and another issue that I've watched you throughout your public service career, campaign finance reform.
Yes.
You and the late Chief Justice, Nat Heffernan, co-chaired that panel. Yeah. That was in the 90s. That was X number of years ago. Then it must have been ironic to you to develop a campaign budget for $11 million. Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic long-term that there will be campaign finance reforms, or are you not optimistic?
President Obama has said that he is committed to it, but he didn't take public financing in his run for election. I sit on the board of directors of a national organization, Americans for Campaign Reform, that is totally bipartisan. They have Bill Bradley and Alan Simpson and Bob Kerry and, forgetting the fourth Republican senator, on their leadership board. And we feel like they're working, their first goal is national public financing mm-hmm. of congressional races. And there's some good reason for optimism. There was more reason for optimism with this last Congress, and we'll see, because the Republican leaders in our organization are so articulate and determined and visible in an important way, and the board of directors is very strong, that we will work on it. I have long felt that this also has to happen in the states, and maybe first has to happen in more states, but it has to be led by a governor. And that was one of the things that motivated me to do something as crazy, in the sense of the rigors and the vulnerability that you invite mm-hmm. in a campaign is a little sadomasochistic. You think, whoa.
Well, but
I wanted to lead campaign finance reform in Wisconsin, and it will only happen when it is led from the governor's
office. What about the Citizens United ruling? I mean, we don't have much time, but Citizens United, a setback for the cause of campaign finance reform, can it be overturned? Can we have disclosure of third party?
We simply must.
We simply must.
Can it? The job ahead of us is to articulate what this costs for all of us and why we will never have government we can afford until we get public financing of campaigns. So when we find enough people running for office or people using the media in other ways to do the public education campaign that has to happen, you can't afford it the way it is now. We simply cannot. I mean, look at, what do you mean we couldn't get global climate change legislation here that was just going to offer support for some job creation that we really need, and we're watching that job creation happen in other places and other countries, and we're losing it because we're not making that a focus. And it all because of a short-sighted vision of what will contribute to a sustainable economy.
Well, we're about out of time. Final question. Summarize your career in public service. Candidate for statewide office, 98, 2002, 2006. Elected 2002, 2006.
It was a great privilege to serve. And it was one of the most, outside of raising children, which you know is a very creative act that never ends.
Challenging, yes.
Yes. It was an opportunity to have an impact on things that were very important to me. But it was mostly a privilege to be in a position to work with and help citizens across Wisconsin.
Thank you for a walk down memory lane.
Thank you.
We'll be curious to see.
Me too.
When you open the next door, but
yes.
You're curious too.
Yes.
Thanks for stopping in.
Barbara
Lawton, thanks for stopping in. Thanks.
You.